The Agriculture Conservation and Resiliency Subcommittee will now come to order. Missy, please call the roll.
Chair Buchanan?
Here.
Vice Chair Roth? Ranking Member Skidmore? Representative Abbott?
Here.
Representative Alvarez?
Here, ma'am.
Representative Antone?
Here.
Representative Bartleman?
Here.
Representative Otana?
Here.
Representative Brackett?
Here.
Representative Usada Cabrera?
Here.
Representative Cassell?
Here.
Representative Cheney?
Here.
Representative Esposito?
Here.
Representative Hunchofsky?
Here.
Representative Mooney?
Here.
Representative Steele is excused. Representative Trunell?
Here.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Members, and announcements before we get started. I just want to remind everyone to make sure they move their electronic devices to silent or turn them off during the duration of our meeting. Members, today we'll have two presentations before our committee. Up first, we're going to be hearing from Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, which will be given by Lieutenant Colonel Brian Smith, who is the Deputy Director of the Division of Law Enforcement. He's going to provide us a little bit of an overview of the derelict vessel program. And so we're going to welcome Lieutenant Colonel to give your presentation. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You about covered my whole first slide. So good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Thank you for having me here today to discuss our derelict vessel situation here in the state of Florida and FWC's role and how we play in the investigation, removal, and prevention of derelict vessels. So this presentation is going to provide an overview of derelict vessels and the DV program within FWC. So derelict vessels are a priority for FWC. The Division of Law Enforcement's Boating and Waterways section is spearheading a multi-year effort to dramatically reduce the backlog of derelict vessels currently on the waters of the state. Unfortunately, derelict vessels continue to be documented by law enforcement on an ongoing basis. Currently, there are approximately 1,100 active derelict vessel investigations statewide in our statewide derelict vessel database. These cases are being investigated by FWC and local law enforcement as potential crimes if they are not brought into compliance or removed by the owners. On average, about 600 new derelict vessels are added to the DV database annually. Many of these derelict vessels are removed by owners, insurance companies, or may be brought into compliance year over year, excluding vessels rendered derelict by hurricanes. We see a running total of about 600 derelict vessels in the state at any one time. On this map, you can see the location of all of our derelict vessels across the state. The red dots represent derelict vessels that are a potential hazard to navigation. 232 of these vessels have been authorized for removal, and local governments are applying for grants. And 326 of these vessels have gone through the grant funding process and are awaiting removal by contractors. Now, many of the vessels you see here in the Fort Myers region on this map were rendered derelict by Hurricane Ian. In total, about 567 of these dots can be attributed to impacts from Hurricane Ian. So what is a derelict vessel? Florida law defines a derelict vessel as a vessel that's left, stored, or abandoned in a wrecked, junked, or substantially dismantled condition upon public waters of the state. A vessel can become derelict due to owner neglect, abandoning a vessel because someone's moved away, or they no longer have the financial means to care for it. And of course, we see derelict vessels that are rendered derelict from natural disasters. Now, long-term stored vessels are often rendered derelict by hurricanes. In 2017, 945 vessels were rendered derelict and removed in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma. These vessels were in addition to the vessels identified prior to the hurricane. I'll go into more detail on long-term stored vessels later in the presentation. So in addition to being an eyesore, derelict vessels, whether they're sinking, hard aground, stripped of vessel components, or missing vital operational systems such as steering, propulsion, or hull integrity, the result is the same. Derelict vessels create a risk to our residents, our visitors, and natural resources of Florida. Leaving a vessel on waters of the state in derelict condition is a crime. 656 derelict vessel citations and 21 warnings have been issued in the last 3 years. Through proactive measures and investigations, FWC and local law enforcement officers are authorized to investigate vessels to determine if they are derelict and order vessel owners to bring them into compliance or remove them from state waters. While any law enforcement agency in Florida is authorized to conduct these criminal investigations, the FWC is the lead agency in Florida for derelict vessels, which falls under one of our core missions within boating safety. After a vessel is determined derelict, FWC officers investigate, charge the responsible party, and work with local governments to hire marine contractors to perform removal, destruction, and disposal work. The process. It can be a very lengthy and expensive process to remove derelict vessels. And that can be for many reasons. It can be complex mainly because of the type of vessel, where it's located, and things of that nature. A derelict vessel in the initial part can be either come through a complaint from the public or can be observed by an officer in the field. If derelict, the officer begins the investigation. The officer will attempt to identify and locate the owner or responsible party. Once they've been located and identified, we may issue a criminal citation and give a notice of rights packet to the vessel owner. The vessel is then posted with a derelict vessel sticker, and the 21-day countdown to removal authorization begins. Owners are afforded an opportunity to have an administrative hearing on the determination of their vessel being derelict. If no owner is identified, the vessel is stickered, and we continue through that 21-day notice period. If the owner does not request a hearing within 21 days, or if the owner is found guilty in criminal court for the violation, the vessel will be authorized for removal and disposal. Once the local government agrees to remove the vessel, they may apply for funding to reimburse the cost of removal and disposal of the vessel. Once that vessel has been removed and disposed of, the officer will send the vessel owner a letter of demand for removal cost, repayment of removal costs. If the costs are not repaid in full, the vessel owner loses his privileges to register a motor vehicle or vessel in the state of Florida until full payment is received. Derelict vessels are removed from the water to reduce their considerable impact. Removals can be complicated and very expensive, and costs can vary widely depending on circumstances. Once again, size and type and where the vessel is located. The appropriate authority, whether it's a local government or FWC, follows state contracting guidelines to secure competitive bids from marine contractors who then remove the vessel and destroy it. Grant funding is available to local governments for 100% removal cost. The FWC is now authorized to contract directly with marine contractors in the fourth quarter of the fiscal year so that we can do direct removals and not go through the grant process. So new legislation, increased funding for removals, and stronger enforcement efforts have resulted in an increase in the number and pace of removals. The Florida legislature and Governor DeSantis have supported derelict vessel removal efforts through increased fiscal appropriations over the last few years, which the legislature has directed us, FWC, to administer to local governments as grants. This increase in funding has led to an increase in derelict vessel removals. During fiscal year 21-22, $3.5 million was appropriated for derelict vessel removal, nearly twice the appropriation of the previous fiscal year. With this funding, FWC has worked with local partners to remove more than 220 derelict vessels from state waters. On average, a derelict vessel typically costs between $400 and $800 per foot to remove. So a 30-foot vessel, barring any extraordinary circumstances, is likely to cost between $12,000 and $24,000 to remove. And it's important to note here that without the partnership, support, and buy-in from local governments, we would not have been able to achieve these results. The FWC has limited staff dedicated to the administrative portion of derelict vessel removal, and local governments perform a vital service through the grant program by procuring bids, securing contracts, and monitoring performance. We could not have done this without their participation. So as I previously mentioned, vessels can be rendered derelict overnight and in great numbers by hurricanes. The three most recent hurricanes where FWC saw devastating effects on vessels was Irma in 2017, Michael in 2018, and most recently, Hurricane Ian. For Hurricane Irma, the combined state and federal response spent $52 million to remove 945 vessels. For Hurricane Michael, $16.2 million was spent on 175 vessels. Most recently, FWC sent multiple deployments of personnel dedicated to the process of assessing the large number of derelict vessels in the aftermath of Hurricane Ian. We issued best practices for vessel owners for removing their vessels and encouraged owners to hire professional salvage companies to recover their vessels to provide the safest method possible for the vessel and for the environment. We created a Hurricane Ian vessel hotline to report missing, displaced, and damaged vessels, and to report when a vessel owner removed their vessel from the water. Now, if repairs or salvage was unrealistic or impossible for a vessel owner, the FWC offered a means of turning the vessel over to the state of Florida to facilitate the removal and disposal of the vessel through a waiver process. Many of the vessels displaced by Hurricane Ian were insured, and one insurer in particular received nearly 3,000 claims for vessels affected by Hurricane Ian. They began the processing of claims quickly and started the recovery, salvage, and repair process. And working with FWC and partner agencies kept us informed of where those vessels were, which ones they were involved with. For Hurricane Ian, statistics have not been fully realized and may not be for some time. We have documented more than 900 vessels rendered derelict because of the storm. Nearly 600 of those have been removed already through state removal efforts, insurance companies, and private owners. We received 248 derelict vessel waivers from owners, and 52 of the still remaining vessels are slated for removal soon. And our officers are continuing to prioritize and process the remaining 300 vessels. The Division of Emergency Management is coordinating the hurricane derelict vessel removal efforts for Hurricane Ian. And we estimate that roughly 950 vessels will have been removed as a result of the storm. So knowing that in any given year, as many as 600 new DVs can be added to the database, the best way we can get ahead of the curve is through prevention. Recent legislation enabled FWC to create a derelict vessel prevention program, and we have multiple components in that important piece that I'd like to cover today. The first component is the long-term stored vessel, which was directed by the legislature. So I've used that term a couple of times already. And so for the purpose of the long-term stored vessel study, that definition is a boat on state waters not under supervision of a person capable of operating, maintaining, or moving it from one location to another, and has remained anchored or moored outside of a public mooring field for at least 30 days out of a 60-day period. The purpose of that study is to determine what the extent of long-term stored vessels contribute to the number of derelict and abandoned vessels on Florida waters. To determine the impacts of long-term stored vessels during and after a tropical storm or hurricane event, and provide recommendations for appropriate management options for long-term stored vessels to mitigate and identify any negative impacts to local communities and the state. There's a 2-year time frame for completion of the study, and we're confident that it will provide us with more data to effectively manage these vessels in the future. Another important piece of the derelict vessel prevention program has to do with vessels that are not yet derelict, but at risk. Outside of hurricanes, vessels generally just don't appear on the water in derelict condition. Several criteria have been identified as indicators that unless corrected could lead to a vessel becoming derelict. These vessels are at risk of becoming derelict, and criteria for at-risk vessels can be found in Florida statutes. So law enforcement officers routinely conduct vessel inspections, documenting the condition through citations and warnings, all in an effort to encourage the vessel owner to bring their vessel into compliance before it becomes derelict. Some of those conditions are listed here, such as taking on water without effective means to dewater, spaces on the vessel open to the elements, has broken loose or is in danger of breaking loose, listing due to water intrusion, no effective means of propulsion, or tied to an unpermitted structure or mooring. The number of at-risk vessels is difficult to quantify, since these vessels may fall out of compliance but then be brought back into compliance by owners after receiving a citation or warning. Since January 1, 2022, FWC has issued 543 citations and 168 warnings for at-risk vessels. Violations of these at-risk conditions are non-criminal infractions with an increasing fine amount for repeat violations. So it begins at a $100 fine, a subsequent violation would go to $250, and then the next one at $500. Now, if a vessel owner is convicted three times within an 18-month period for the same at-risk condition, their vessel may be declared a public nuisance and may be removed as if it were a derelict vessel using DV removal funding. This new removal authority provides a means by which vessels can be removed from the water before they become derelict. Environmental impacts and removal costs for at-risk vessels are significantly lower than cost for removing a vessel that has already become derelict. Another component of our DV prevention program is our newly instituted Vessel Turn-In Program, or VTIP for short. Authorized under Florida statutes, VTIP may prevent vessels from becoming derelict by offering removal from the waters of the state when they are at risk of becoming derelict, which will result in a cost savings to the taxpayer and ultimately fewer derelict vessels appearing on Florida waters. Owners that take advantage of this opportunity avoid additional fines for future at-risk violations, expenses to bring the vessel into compliance, and criminal charges if their vessel were to become derelict, and thousands of dollars in reimbursement costs should the vessel have to be removed as a public nuisance or derelict vessel. VTIP is both voluntary and free to the at-risk vessel owner. An eligible participant includes somebody that's the titled owner of the at-risk vessel who has received a citation or a written warning from a law enforcement officer at least once for a derelict vessel. All fees for removal, destruction, and disposal are paid by FWC through derelict vessel prevention funds. It's much cheaper to remove an at-risk vessel than a derelict vessel, primarily because an at-risk vessel, by definition, is still floating. Currently, the FWC does not have statistics to show the extent of the cost savings, but staff anticipates it will be considerable, potentially saving taxpayers millions of dollars. Because the program is so new, we can't yet estimate how many vessel owners may take advantage of VTIP. However, since the program started, roughly around September of 2022, 19 vessel owners have applied for VTIP. And out of those 19, eight of those are awaiting contractors to remove the vessels. Due to the historic reoccurring number of at-risk and derelict vessels every year, we are hopeful that this program will help shift the focus from removals to prevention. FWC continues to put the emphasis on the importance of derelict vessel mitigation, and recent changes provide an opportunity for future success. Many of the changes to how we deal with derelict vessels and prevention efforts in particular are relatively new, but we're confident that they will provide positive results. The FWC recently upgraded our derelict vessel database, which provides more accurate and timely tracking of cases, approvals, removals, and statistics. The grant process has been streamlined to make the application and reimbursement process to local governments faster and easier. And we continue to provide training to all interested law enforcement officers, increase at-risk enforcement, and educate the public, with the ultimate goal of keeping our waterways clean and safe from derelict vessels. Mr. Chairman and committee, that concludes my presentation. I thank you for your time today. And again, I am Lieutenant Colonel Brian Smith, FWC Division of Law Enforcement, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for that presentation, Lieutenant Colonel. Members, questions? Representative Botana, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel. Just have to say the VTIP system is great. That's good stuff for our area. Quick question. Is salvage under a lump sum contract with additions, or is it per vessel?
Lieutenant Colonel, you're recognized.
That I can't answer, but I can find an answer. I don't know if my CFO may know that, but I can get that information and get back to you on that.
Members, questions? Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lieutenant Colonel. For those of us who are boaters, how can we help? Because I think that boaters are really great stewards of our waterways. And I know that my husband and I, when we're out, we see boats underwater and for years sitting in some of our waterways. And they don't seem to be getting any attention. What can we, the public boating community, do to help you in this effort? Is there a hotline we could have to report vessels as opposed to the hotline that you have that is for boat owners?
Lieutenant Colonel, you're recognized.
Obviously, any help that we can get from the boating public is absolutely, you know, needed. And many of the tips that we do get and our attention is called to derelict vessels from the boating public, as well as business owners and things of that nature. And there is, I don't know if is there a hotline for DVs itself? Our dispatch number. So it's and I can get you that number, but it's essentially 1-888 404-FWCC, right? That's it. So it's essentially our hotline for all things that you would want to report. There's a lot of reasons that you see vessels sit for long periods of time. Hopefully, it's not so much the case anymore. Many times, it's because we simply aren't aware that it's there. A lot of times, they're in areas that our officers may not normally patrol, in backwaters, bayous, things of that nature that we just don't see. Other times, vessels have sat for long periods of time before, you know, several legislative changes that allowed us to change how we do the grants, for instance. It used to be a 50% match from local governments. So if a local government simply didn't have the funding to put up 50% of $50,000 for a vessel removal, it sat there. But that's how it was written in statute, and that's how we had to administrate it. And so now that's going away. So it's 100%, you know, of reimbursement to local governments, which has really helped. A lot of other times, local governments will, if they have multiple vessels, especially in one general location, they will wait until all of those vessels have cleared the appropriate timelines. They've all been approved for removal, so they can hire one contractor to do the one job and get it all done at one time. So there's a lot of reasons that they sit around. Unfortunately, one of the biggest reasons is for years there was no, you know, there was no funding to remove them. That has not been the problem here in recent years. We've been very fortunate to have received appropriations from the legislature continuously to get these boats out of the water, and we continue to work on it. And we appreciate your help.
Members, questions? Representative Cheney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan, and thank you for the presentation. I just want to thank the FWC and the Sheriff's Office in my District 61 in Pinellas County. You all have done a great job with the derelict vessel. And once we passed this new law, it was close to 80 vessels got pulled out of my area in Pinellas County within a few months. So it's a great law. It's working. I also am aware that 120-day wait time while you track down an owner who's often in some place like California, for instance, what percentage of those that are in that process do you ever actually track down?
Lieutenant Colonel, you're recognized.
I'm not sure what percentage we actually track down, and I'm not sure about the 120 days. So if we cannot find a responsible party or an owner, we can stagger the boat and start our 21, you know, day process immediately. As long as we made it, we can show that we made a good faith effort to try to identify the owner. A lot of times there may be no identifying marks on the boat. They may have been stripped with, you know, of FL numbers, and there's no ghost numbers to go by, and we can't get to the hen, or the hen may be removed. We can't get to the hidden hen because it's submerged. And if we can't readily identify, you know, an owner, we start that process immediately. What takes a lot of time sometimes is we have a lot of people that store their vessels here in the state of Florida, often on the water, that don't even live in the state of Florida. A lot of times they may live up north. And so, you know, we still have to, you know, do our due diligence to try to identify the owner. So I don't know really how to speed up that process anymore. I know a lot of the hurdles we've had in the past have been removed, and those processes are picking up.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. And I know at one point we were having a backup from lack of contractor availability. Is that still the case?
Lieutenant Colonel.
That's really changed too. We've got there's a lot of people. I think a lot of people realize that there's a lot of work out there to do. And I feel like we've got more contractors than we've historically had in the past, which has allowed a lot of the removals to go a lot quicker.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Casellan, questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lieutenant Colonel, for a really interesting presentation. I really wanted to focus my questions with regards to the reimbursement to local government. I'm glad to hear that it's a streamlined effort, but having the opportunity to be on the Hurricane Committee, we heard last week from several officials that really talked about the financial burdens and constraints that are placed on municipalities' budgets after a hurricane because of the loss in tax revenue. Are you running into any situations where local governments just don't have the additional funds to care for these and shell out the cost and wait for the reimbursement? Is there any hindrance there? And if so, can we transfer from not a reimbursement program, but where the money, you know, you receive the invoice for the cost and it's paid directly out of the budget rather than local municipalities having to front that cost in the first place?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Currently, right now, it's that way because it's that way, you know, statutorily to be administered as a grant. The outside of hurricanes, we don't see that burden as big, with the exception of some of your smaller rural counties. And that is where we take our opportunity during the fourth quarter of every fiscal year. Where we're allowed to do direct removals with the money that's left over. I kind of direct staff to, let's look for those problem areas where vessels have languished for years because counties haven't been able to afford to remove them, and we kind of attack it that way. With regards to hurricanes, it is a major, you know, strain on everyone, and I'm not sure what the silver bullet is for that, but I know that we've worked considerably with DEM this year. They've done an amazing job, been an incredible partner this year with derelict vessels. We've done more this year with this hurricane, with Hurricane Ian, than we ever have with the response of hurricane vessels, and I think it'll probably end up eclipsing what it was with Irma, but it was a little slow getting started and getting everybody kind of on the same page with what a derelict vessel actually was, not to include vessels that are sitting high on dry land. But they've been an incredible partner, and I don't know that we would be where we are now if DEM hadn't picked up the actual removal part of it. Our sworn members are out there doing the assessments, identifying vessels, making owner contacts, issuing notice of rights to individuals, stickering vessels, and doing all of that work. And then once all time periods have passed and a vessel is approved for removal, we simply turn packages over to DEM, and they've been working with contractors that we had previously approved for other projects to go ahead and do the removal. So it's gone pretty good. So with regard to the hurricanes, I don't believe local governments have had to spend money on the removals of DVs. I could be wrong, but I believe so far it's all been handled through DEM, and so there won't even be a need for a reimbursement. But I do agree with you at times. It's very difficult for some of these counties to put the money up front to seek reimbursement.
Lieutenant Colonel, I had just a question to piggyback off that. You had mentioned, you say 900 vessels identified as a result of Ian, is that correct?
Yes, sir, roughly. We expect that there will be that many, you know.
And so with previous storms, Irma and Michael, we have 945, 175. Over what period of time is that then attributed to that storm event? For instance, in this presentation you have. So moving forward, for instance, is it that 900 number that that's already been identified, or there?
Those would have been vessels that were not derelict and in our database prior to the storm. So that's how we track that number. That would have been the same for Irma and Michael. So it adds to, we end up putting them in our database to work them, but we track that number by, you know, we know how many were in the database prior to the storm, and that's how we kind of come up with that number.
So is 900 then for Ian attributed to the storm, or that was in the database pre-Ian?
Now, we're expecting to remove that many as a result of the storm, vessels that were rendered derelict by the storm.
Right. Okay. Okay. And just on another subject, how often is, after the removal process, are those funds recovered from the owner?
That I don't know. I know in certain cases that we have had to enter into settlement agreements with individuals because of the you know, it's a pretty incredible cost for the removal and disposal. And we have basically taken whatever they can offer and entered into settlement agreements where they've agreed never to register a vessel in the state of Florida again.
Is there any idea on frequency or... members, questions? Representative Brackett, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Lieutenant Colonel, first of all, I want to commend your organization, what you've done. I've had the pleasure to work with FWC extensively. I was elected official on a town that was located on Indian River Lagoon in South Central Florida, so I thank you for that. But my question is similar to Representative Cheney's, and that is, in 2022, when you did the investigation, how many individuals did you end up citing, and what exactly does that mean? What is the punishment when you say we cited somebody?
Well, Lieutenant Colonel.
When we cite, we're essentially issuing a notice to appear for a second degree misdemeanor. So that's it. It is a criminal charge. Typically, we don't take people to jail for it, but it is essentially a non-custodial arrest when we issue the citation for the criminal violation of derelict vessel.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. Second question is, I guess this goes in time with what else can be done from our standpoint as a legislative body or from a local municipality standpoint, because if you look at the numbers you presented, you removed about 239 vessels last year of 1,156, if my memory is right. And I know from where I live and what I represent that those vessels grow quickly out there, unfortunately, and as someone who is from that area, lifelong resident, we didn't see this 30 years ago like we do today. And so it's an ever-growing problem, and I think your agency is doing a wonderful job handling it, but we've got to get resources or programs in place to help as much as we can. And so from either a local level or here, what do you see as the next step?
Lieutenant Colonel.
That was the million-dollar question that I've been waiting to get asked. I thought I might slip by without anybody asking that one. It's... You know, this is a problem that I really don't think there is a silver bullet for. We've been fortunate to have effective legislation passed, the appropriations for removal funds, all that is great. This is a problem that we can't necessarily solve with legislation or money. There's somewhat of a adaptive challenge here that a technical fix won't absolutely fix. And one of the potential fixes out there with regard to long-term stored vessels would probably be fairly unpalatable to a lot of people, and I don't even know if we constitutionally could do it. But I say that to say that prevention is where we have to focus. We've got the appropriations to remove vessels, and that's great. We've got the statutory, authority to do a lot of things that are really helping us in moving this ball forward. But it doesn't matter how much money we have, if that's all we focus on is removal, then that's all we'll do is just we'll be content to just remove vessels from the state of Florida waters. So we have to focus on the prevention piece. And there's a personal accountability piece here for individuals that own vessels, and most importantly for individuals that own vessels and store them on waters of the state. And that's where I think I'm assuming that we're going to see a lot come out of the long-term stored vessel study that will probably point in that direction. And then it'll be, try to determine how we can, once we know that, right now it's all anecdotal. When you have X number of derelict vessels in the database, and let's say Lee and Charlotte County, and then after a storm comes through, you've got three or four times that many, that tells you something. Where did those vessels come from? And all derelict vessels aren't vessels that are stored on the water. However, you have various reasons people will dump a vessel, an old boat they don't want anymore. They'll back it up to a boat ramp, kick it off the trailer, and it'll float across from the boat ramp and end up in the mangrove somewhere and becomes a derelict vessel. You may have some vessels that are wrecked. Somebody wrecks their vessel somewhere and walks away from it and leaving a derelict vessel. However, we find the overwhelming majority of vessels that become derelict on state waters are vessels that are stored there. They're at anchor somewhere, potentially tied to a dock behind a property somewhere, and, you know, neglected, and they end up becoming derelict. So I think that's kind of, we have to focus on prevention to keep them from becoming derelict. And then the cost of removing a vessel when it's at risk and still floating really pales in comparison to removing something that's sunk. You have a vessel that's sunk, a contractor has to come float the vessel, pump it out, actually pump contaminants off of it, put it on a crane. You've seen some of the, with a crane, put it on a barge. You've seen some of the pictures, and then take it somewhere to be disposed of. Where if through the VTIP, or if a vessel is declared a public nuisance by, you know, three or more at-risk violations within an 18-month period, we remove that vessel, it's floating. Essentially, your contractor can tow it somewhere because it's floating, get it up on land, destroy it, and the removal process is a lot cheaper. And as far as getting vessels off of the water quicker, whether it's during hurricanes and things of that nature, one thing that we did do that was done during Irma or after Irma and after Michael was in working with Coast Guard and Unified Command, we actually removed vessels from the water and moved them to a location on land and stored them there until all these time periods expired. That is incredibly expensive. It will cost you near as much and sometimes more to load some of these vessels onto some sort of truck and trailer and move them to a location on land where you're likely having to pay storage fees to store the vessels. It can literally cost $30,000 or $40,000 to move a boat on land to a place to store it. And then you wait that time period, and then oftentimes your self-recover, owner recovery won't happen because by the time they get to the storage location and want to claim their boat and find out how much money it'll cost them to get it back somewhere on the water, they simply can't afford it and have to sign it over to us anyway. So it's just, it's an incredibly expensive thing to deal with no matter how you deal with it. But removal and storing during hurricanes and things of that nature is an option to get them off of the water quicker. You still have the time periods before you could destroy the boat, but it's incredibly expensive.
Vice Chair Roth, any questions?
Thank you, Chair, and I'm glad I waited because you did just answer some of my questions. First one is just common sense. You said something about how some vessels on the water that have been abandoned, there's no identifying marks. So the dumb question would be, we have VIN numbers on cars. Why can't we have VIN numbers on boats, numbers that cannot be removed?
Lieutenant Colonel.
There are HIN numbers on boats. It's usually, most of the time, it's on a plate affixed to the stern of the boat. Sometimes it's engraved in the boat. And there are hidden HINs on vessels, like on automobiles. But if it's submerged partially and you can't get to it to see it, you would still have to remove the boat in order to locate a HIN. But there are HIN numbers on vessels.
Rep. Roth, follow-up.
Yes, sir. Another question. So going to preventative, is there a different classification for different types of boats? For example, some boats obviously have a toilet on board, and they are being used as, you know, home on the water. Are those categorized differently, and do they pay a different annual registration fee?
Lieutenant Colonel.
No, sir, they don't pay an additional fee. Obviously, there's requirements for vessels for their marine sanitation devices and things of that nature. Areas where you can't discharge at all, areas where you can discharge treated, you know, sewage into the waters. But there's no different classification. Essentially, vessel registrations and whatnot are associated with the length of the vessel.
Rep. Roth, follow up.
So similar question. With using a database kind of thought process to do preventative action, you know, it'd be nice to know where these boats are ahead of time. I'm just wondering, would it be something we could do legislatively to create more information in the registration process, such as store the boat on land at this location, store the boat on water at that location? I don't know enough to ask an intelligent question. Can you help me with that? How we could possibly require more information of a boat owner so that we can identify or maybe find their boat before a hurricane?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Vice Chair, I'm not really sure what we could do in that realm. That's something that we can, you know, consider. There's been the biggest thing is should, you know, I think that's been talked about internally is should vessel owners that store their vessel on the water have some, either whether it's a permitted process that allows you to stay on the water so we'd know where you were, or there was something identified in a registration, or all vessels. There's already a portion of vessel registration goes into a fund for derelict vessel removal. But it's difficult. We've discussed, insurance requirements for people that store their vessels on the water. There's different ideas that have been, considered in an effort to try to mitigate the taxpayer expense for removal of these vessels once they become derelict.
Vice Chair Roth.
Yes, sir. So going to the funding part, first of all, when you talked about the VTIP program and talking about voluntary removal, that's not done for free. They're charged a fee to do that, right?
No, sir.
That's done for free.
Apologize, sir. No, it's done for free. If a person has received a citation or warning, at least one, for an at-risk violation, we essentially have a pamphlet about VTIP, and we hand them the pamphlet at the same time we issue them the citation, and let them know that if they feel they're going to be unable to get their vessel back into compliance, that this is an option. And although we understand that there's no reimbursement cost for that, as an agency, we just feel that the more important thing right now is preventing that vessel from becoming derelict, preventing the potential environmental hazards, and understanding that we just won't be compensated for the removal.
Representative Bartleman, any questions?
Thank you, Chair. I just have one question. Since you're moving from the derelict to the at-risk, what are you doing with the ones that are at risk that possibly could be restored? Do you try to sell them to generate revenue? Because someone might just say, take it, but you still may be able to do something with it.
Lieutenant Colonel.
We found, and that's a very common question, especially asked with derelict vessels. With boats, it's unlike automobiles, there's very little value in a vessel for salvage. So most of these vessels that we're talking about, even when they're at risk, they're in pretty bad shape. So what it would take to bring them into compliance, it may not cost that much money, but even if we were to take the vessel from them in a turn-in program, or if we ended up taking the vessel after it was declared as a public nuisance, there's really no value in the vessel at all. And little in recycling as well. As far as fiberglass, there's some things that just can't be recycled. And depending on the age of the vessel, there's a lot of things on those vessels that it's even difficult to be accepted in landfills.
Members, questions? Representative Botana.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Lieutenant Colonel, with your testimony and the questions that we're having, would you be safe to say that it's better to rent, not buy a boat, or maybe join a boat club?
Lieutenant Colonel, if you want to give that a shot, you can.
I have friends with boats, Representative. I don't own a boat myself.
You know what they say, Rep. Botana, the happiest day is the day you buy it, the day you sell it. So any more questions, members? Representative Cheney.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. So along the lines of prevention, in my district, I know FWC and the sheriff is really good about patrolling, and you know by name who the vessel owners are, you know the status of the vessels, and you keep a real close eye on them, and I think you've integrated yourself as well as the sheriff kind of into that boating community so that they trust you. They're not necessarily, unless the ones who have a reason to be concerned that you're coming around. So I think the patrolling is an effective program, and I'd encourage my other members to be in touch with your local FWC and sheriffs and see how they're doing that. In my district, a lot of the vessels have turned into affordable housing for like restaurant workers predominantly. So it's a good solution for the community, although it does lead to some of these problems we're talking about. And I know one of the solutions that Rep Mooney has in his district that works well are mooring fields. And what I understand is it's about $250 a month for a person to tie up to a ball. And with that, they get pump out service and you're assured that their vessels are in good condition. Can you just speak to that of, you know, should we be encouraging that? Is there something that we can do? Is there a lot of resistance in the community to mooring fields? Do you see that as a good solution? Just speak to that topic, if you would.
Lieutenant Colonel.
We think mooring fields are a great idea. We think they work out very well in the areas where we actually have, the mooring fields throughout the state. There's multiple mooring fields in Monroe County and some more balls going in soon. And during the, a couple years ago, we ran a mooring pilot project through the state, and there were several municipalities that ran them. And the positive things that came out of them, really outweigh any negatives. The difference being is, a lot of people, sit at anchor and live on a vessel and not pay anything. And so to, go into a mooring field and get on a mooring ball and have to pay, that's the expense they weren't paying before. It does help kind of clean up an area because you can't anchor in, a permitted mooring field. You're either paying your to be on the ball or you're not in there. And when you look at these areas that have these permitted, mooring fields, it looks a lot different than areas where you just have people anchored up. But it is true what you said about, and it is that way in a lot of areas with affordable housing. It's a huge issue for Monroe County. That's probably the majority of the folks that are living on vessels down there. That is truly their home down there.
Members, any further questions? Representative Mooney.
Thank you, Chair. Lieutenant Colonel, thank you. thank you for supporting that, cleaning up that bill last year. Excuse me. Would it be safe to say if you had more officers, we'd have fewer derelict vessels? That's a loaded question. You know that because we've been fighting for more officers for decades in the Keys. So a quick answer to that may maybe try and get you some more officers with higher pay.
Lieutenant Colonel.
Obviously, the more folks we have, the more enforcement of everything that's, within our purview is easier. It can be difficult in areas, and of course, Monroe County can be difficult to keep, officers there as well. Obviously, the more eyes you have out there and bodies you have out there on the water patrolling these areas to be able to observe the vessels and kind of keep track of what's going on in their area, it's much easier to especially work towards prevention with working at-risk vessels.
Members, questions? Lieutenant Colonel. Thank you for that great presentation, entertaining all of our questions. We're grateful to you for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, up next, we have Commissioner Wilton Simpson with the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services joining us to discuss the Department's Rural and Family Lands Protection Program. And I just want to note to members, before I recognize our commissioner, who we're really excited to have here, there is a one-pager regarding this presentation in your packet. So I want everyone to be aware of that. Commissioner Simpson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. And I will try to be brief. That was a great presentation. Our Family Rural Lands Act was put into place in 2001 by the legislature. At that time, we recognized the importance of our food supply. We realized the importance of buying these development rights from farms so that you didn't have complete encroachment upon all of the things that we really value. Since 2001, from 2001 and 21, there was about $100 million appropriated to the Family Rural Lands Act. In 22, we appropriated $300 million, so three times what had been previously put in place. And when you look at the accomplishment, what are we trying to accomplish with the Rural Family Lands Act? First of all, we're trying to keep the land into farmers' hands. These landowners then, it keeps that property on the tax roll. It keeps this property into your farming community, and it allows them to have generational opportunities to continue to pass that farm down and stay a part of that food supply. When you look at secondary, but has become more of a primary discussion in the last few years, is the wildlife corridor. So when you think about the wildlife corridor, if you want to define that, if you look at a, and it's well-defined, we did that in legislation the last few years, if you look at a map of the state of Florida at nighttime, you'll see where all the lights are. Wherever it's dark is where we would be in the family rural lands. It would be where your wildlife corridor is. And then when you think about our natural water recharge and what's most important to our aquifer here in the state of Florida, it also resides in this farmland and in that wildlife corridor and in where the rural family lands purchases would primarily happen. A lot of times, and by the way, this is just another tool in the toolbox. When you think of some of the bills that we're doing this year to protect long-term farming, when you think of the right to farm bill we did a few years ago, we sometimes don't place farming into the bucket of national security issues. We certainly want to continue to ramp up our, you know, to let everybody know the national security issue that it is. We all know that oil and our energy policy is a national security issue. We get told that every year, and if you lived back in the 70s, as I did through the 70s, it was a national security issue then, and we've heard about it ever since. We don't always think of food in that same respect. And I would tell you that we can overcome $125, $150 barrel oil if we have to. We have. We just did recently. And but what you can overcome, and think of it in terms of this, is 7 days of no food in the grocery store. And so we think of, we've got this natural strategic supply for energy, but not necessarily for our food supply. And so I always thought about it as, think of Germany 30 years ago when they made the decision to buy cheap Russian natural gas through pipelines that they were going to distribute from Russia into Western Europe. And under that time, they were saying, well, there's no way Russia would ever cut our energy off, right? Because that would be complete chaos within the European Union. And then now let's fast forward to 2022, and clearly a war with Ukraine, and then Russia cut off the energy supply, and then they actually blew up the pipelines that go into Western Europe. So they not only cut it off, they completely destroyed the system to bring it in. When you think of your food supply, Florida is a very large grower of food products for this country. We export a lot of food. Think of 80% of your vegetables being grown in South Florida every year on the eastern seaboard of the United States. And think about the stress that the regulatory infrastructure puts on those farmers that are man-made. Let's not consider Irma and other natural disasters and floods, but just consider our responsibility in that. And then let's assume that we overregulate and we ultimately are successful and shut those farmers down. Of course, houses will move in there. Where are we going to grow that food in this country if we don't grow it on those farms? And so if you accept that, you say, well, we would just import more food. Okay. As y'all know, our enemies through the decades change who they are. So which country are we going to rely on to grow our food supply? And then a pandemic happens, right? Well, it hadn't happened in 100 years. Well, we just went through one. And so when you think about food, we need to think of it as national security. When you think about tying it back to rural family lands, you need to think of it in terms of these are going to be generational farmers with generational aspirations. And if a owner sells that land that is to them and the next generation decides not to farm that land, will be other farmers come in and purchase those properties and continue that farming activity in most cases. We're very, one of the things that we've really pushed in the last 3 weeks as we've taken office is the idea that we come to the legislature and say, you know, if you would give us $300 million, it would go a long ways to help with rural family lands or the wildlife corridor. And then we don't get those purchases made for many years to come. And you come back the following year and, hey, give us $300 more million. With the Department of Agriculture, we are in the process now of putting well over $1 billion of opportunities that we make available to this legislature. So if the legislature were to continue to funding resources at the scale that we did last year, 12 months from now, we will have all of that money spent, including the $300 million that we currently have ready to go. And so we always think about opportunities of appraisal, of process, and all those things are very important. But if you want to pay more for these same development rights than you're going to pay today, just wait till next year, and you'll get to pay more. Wait for three more years. So as a legislature, when we've applied dollars sometime to these programs and it takes 4 or 5 years, look what inflation has done in the last 12 months, and then multiply that by the next 5 years. So I think it's incumbent upon us as the Department of Agriculture to spend these resources in a timely fashion, buy these development rights, stop the encroachment, and this is one of the big pieces of the puzzle as we secure Florida's future as, you know, as a farming activity. And the last thing I'll say is I don't like putting agriculture into the economic bucket, but we are the second leading driver of the economy, over $175 billion of economic output, 2.5 million employees, and we can say all of those things. But I think Chris Sprouse said it right from the rostrum a couple of years ago when he said, he was an attorney, as we all know, Speaker Sprouse, and he said, you know, you need an attorney once or twice a year, hopefully not. You need a farmer three times a day. And when we look at any regulatory structure we're going to do, when we look at rural family lands or any of these opportunities we have to enhance farming, that's what we're enhancing, is your food supply, and we want the most safe, affordable, abundant food anywhere in the world. And this is one of those large pieces of that puzzle to make happen. So I appreciate you having me here, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Excellent presentation. Members, going to open it up for questions. There's some questions. Representative Honchowski, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here and for the presentation. I just had a question. I had two questions. What are the criteria that you have to determine a project? And then what do you use to prioritize which one should go first, second, third?
Very, very good question, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner.
Thank you. So thank you, Representative. And our process clearly is making sure that we're dealing with agricultural lands. It's a little different than, say, the DEP's program, I presume, in that aspect. Is we're looking for these legacy farms and protecting our food supply. And then we have a rigorous process, an internal process, where we are evaluating the environmental impacts, the food production, and things of that nature. We obviously have appraisals, surveys, and things of that nature. But our primary reasoning for doing this is to protecting agriculture land in the state of Florida. And then the environmental aspects that come along with that, which are highlighted in our report before we appraise them. So what has happened in the past sometimes is we get caught up with certain landowners that we may want this land in a bad way as a part of the mosaic of our, you know, wildlife corridor, for instance. We're going to have them ranked in strategic locations around the state, and it's going to have obviously our agriculture number one, environment number two, and wildlife corridor. But we are not going to negotiate and hold our, we're going to have a list where if we run into a snag with a specific owner, they've changed their mind, they're negotiating maybe more aggressively or some point, we're going to go to the next one. So we're not going to make excuses of why we couldn't spend your money. We're going to spend it. And what I believe will happen when we do that and when landowners realize they just got passed over and they're still on the list, they can still come back, but we're not going to take years to negotiate. We're going to take our time and do it right, using some of outside vendors to help us with those landowners, and we're going to continuously move. So there is that system in place, the transparency of the process and the environmental concerns and all of the things that would go into that package, but it is our intent to spend this money, and we're gonna go to where we have the least resistance.
Rep. Honchowski with a follow-up.
One follow-up, thank you, Chair. And just to follow, is there a place or a document that would tell us exactly what criteria are used, like what data is used to say this is our number one priority, this is our number two, like just to understand what that formula looks like?
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman. There is, and our team can provide you that. Right, and the handout that we did is, you know, I have some fun facts there, but we can get you a description.
Representative Trunow, the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here today. With what's happening in growth in Florida today and the process that you're following, a couple of things that come to mind with the appraisal process and how that affects the purchase of the property. Explain how far do you go on the appraisal process? You pay 90% of an appraisal, or do you go beyond some of the appraisals because of certain overlays that may be available for that piece of property? How does that look?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And very good question. And I think that through the last decade or so, there's been the idea that we should pay 90% of that appraised value. And so the way I see that, and this, of course, I've been on the job for 3 weeks now, but we do have the appraisal process. We do use certified appraisers that is already approved within the state system, similar as DEP would use or your Water Basin Board. So we're using a similar appraisal process, and we're similar firms. But we are not going to say that we have to only do lands at 90% of value. And I will give you an example. If you are today paying $3,000 an acre for development rights, and you choose to say, well, I'm only going to pay you 90% of that value, $2,700, the surefired way to spend more than $3,000 is just to wait 2 years and come back to them when it appraises for $4,000. And so I think in the state of Florida, and with the pressure of 1,000 people a day moving here, we are now in a position to where if we do not take these properties and keep them in all of the things we've said, the wildlife corridor, farming hands, we're going to lose these properties, and it's going to be to the detriment of our long-term future.
Representative Trunow with a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that process that you're going through, you say you have 131 properties in the queue, you know, estimated that you could fulfill using the money that you have in front of you. How long does that process take once you get these folks in the queue to the finish line? And if we don't have enough time, is there another product maybe that we need to offer up as a legislature to, you know, shorten that gap and or keep those people in the system so that you have some continuity on the right properties that you're seeking?
Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a great question, because it is our intent, if we receive dollars, is to be able to spend those dollars. We have a great department within the forestry. Keith Rowell is our person that heads up this area of the department. And we believe that we have the infrastructure, and we believe that we have the ability to continue to bring a list of, you know, close to $1 billion of opportunities. And we will know all of this in the next 6 months, by the way, because we have the $300 million to spend. But we believe we have all the tools we need, and we just now need to go out and execute that plan. This is a top priority of mine as Commissioner of Agriculture. It's something we've been working on organizing the last few weeks. We have new team members coming into this program here over the next few weeks. But it's something we're focused on, and that'll be an easier question if there's something more we need to do to make it a little easier or a little quicker. But I asked that question, and I believe we're going to reopen up for another opportunity for people to come into this program in a few months. And I believe the response will be another $1 billion worth of opportunities. And so I think we've got the tools we need. We just now need the leadership.
So, Commissioner, and what's the timing on that $300 million? Is it already ready and can be deployed, or what's the timing around that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it can be deployed, and we now are working with the group that's been identified here to start getting those in the queue, and we're hoping at the next cabinet meeting in a few months there may be a few there, but certainly over the next few cabinet meetings we should substantially spend that money. So great. We're going to be very aggressive at getting this money spent.
Great. Thank you. Ranking Member Skidmore, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm excited about the speed without jeopardizing accuracy. It sounds like that is your major goal. I have a question that's a little bit in the weeds. the legislation that we passed that granted the $300 million also gave the opportunity to own the land differently in fee simple. And I'm curious if your agency intends to use that, and if so, how and why?
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That part of the legislation was vetoed, but we would not, we do not want to own lands in the Department of Agriculture. I think it's incumbent upon leaving it on the tax roll. We have a lot of rural counties, small counties, that if we took all of this off the tax roll, we're going to have to backfill those dollars from somewhere. We had one just recently that almost went through the cabinet that would have been that type of operation. So it is not our goal to own any land within the Department of Agriculture, as little as possible. And certainly we will not be seeking out purchasing land. We're wanting to buy development rights, leave this on the tax roll, private hands, farming community, all the things we talked about.
Vice Chair Roth, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate this opportunity. Commissioner Simpson, it's really great to see you. I like your new title. I really do. So you've already mentioned, obviously, that the Department of Agriculture is not interested in fee simple purchases, and they want to keep land on the tax rolls, and I totally agree with that. Totally also agree with the idea of legacy farming, where farmers, I will say grandfathers, want to make sure their grandsons don't sell the farm. They know their son's not going to sell their farm, but they don't know about the grandson yet. So I think what we're going is the right direction. So I want to give you an opportunity, because I've tried for a couple of years to try to amend Florida Forever so that we would have a higher percentage, like, say, 35% for rural and family lands. Even though we don't use that formula, we've been appropriating it separately, I want to give you an opportunity to explain to me and to others why you feel like, you know, we shouldn't try to memorialize a higher percentage under Florida Forever, but instead we should just go with rural and family lands. What's the advantage of going one direction versus the other?
Mr. Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that is a philosophical question that I will try to answer. And serving in the legislature over the 10 years, we thought that our only solution to getting recurring revenue towards the rural family lands may was to go into the Florida Forever program and have a certain percentage coming to our area. What we discovered through the years is that if you have the more layers of the bureaucracy that you have, the less opportunities you have to succeed, in my opinion, in a timely fashion. And so when the legislature the last few years, we put $300 million, I believe, in the Florida Forever program a few years ago, and we said, you know, we want this money to purchase development rights. So I think the legislature has all the tools it needs in the appropriation process to steer these dollars. And I think the Florida Forever program has been a very successful program. And I think a lot of the lands that were purchased early on were probably necessary purchases, heads of, you know, spring sheds and waterways and things of that nature. I'm not certain that a lot of those lands could not be surplused at this time and take the development rights off of them, perhaps, and put it back into the private roles and obviously all the things I mentioned earlier that go along with that. But when you think about the family rural lands, we've had it for 20 years. We have not funded it very well for 20 years, $100 million in 20 years. And so I think now that the legislature's looking at who can go out and make these acquisitions that come to the total goal. So if you're concerned about the wildlife corridor, a lot of the land that we will be buying these development rights from are within that wildlife corridor. If you're worried about encroachment on your ag lands, clearly that's in the heart of the rural family lands. If you're concerned about the major water recharges and nutrient loads within these systems, the better work we do, the less of that there will be. And so I think that when you look at it going forward with best management practices, with buying of the development rights, we can save a lot of Florida, legacy Florida, for the great-great-great-grandchildren of somebody, right? And that's the goal here this is one of the tools in the toolbox, legacy tools, to make sure that 50 years from now, 100 years from now, Florida will be a surplus supplier of food to this country and this world. And I believe, the tools today that we have to do it with.
Follow up, Vice Chair Roth.
Thank you. On a different subject, a little bit different. When we were here last week, we had the deputy secretary of DEP was here. And I asked her this question. I'm going to ask you the same question. With the concern of people moving to Florida and prices for land going up at way, 15, 20% a year, certain lands, and also the fact that farmers are trying to do land swaps. They're trying to sell land and then turn around and buy land to avoid paying capital gains within a certain period of time. Do you see any different thoughts or benefit to possibly renewing the bonding effort? Because we lost that effort, and we've talked about trying to reinstitute it to have another tool in your toolbox. My concern, obviously, is you missing the opportunity to buy that piece of land when it comes available.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I am not a fan of bonding. I like to pay for things as we go. We live in a state that's paid down $12 billion of debt in the last 10, 11 years. And we've cut that much in taxes also, right? So we prioritized a opportunity to expand the pie, not shrink the pie. And I think when you go out and you start bonding over the time, you will shrink your opportunities, not grow them. I think that if we prioritize rural family lands, Florida Forever, like we did the last 2 years, I think $800 million in the last 2 years, we can, with our partners in farming, when they see us spending $400 million a year or more, you're going to excite a lot of people in the countryside. They're going to bring their projects forward. The challenge I think we've had in the past is that, if we would bring $5 or $10 million to a program like this, you're buying a very small parcel of land, the development rights. And so I think that when our citizens see that we make this type of a commitment and our farmers and landowners see this type of commitment, we're going to have a lot more success taking these properties down. I would do it the way we're doing it, pay as you go. I don't want to tie the hands of future legislators by bonding money. And it was something we were very proud of over the last 10 years, the amount of resources that we put here. And what I would say is, we're talking about historic tax cuts. We are taking these opportunities to do that instead of this, right? So as a legislature, you are going to figure that out, and we're going to spend the money you give us.
Representative Cassell, with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. I especially liked hearing directly from you that the mission of the department is to protect long-term farming for generations to come, as well as for that national security component. When we talk about preservation with regards to the Florida Wildlife Corridor, I think at least my assumption is that we're preserving these lands in perpetuity. And I think one of the main differences that I see from the Rural Family Land Statute versus the Florida Forever Statute is Florida Forever's options for purchase are going to be either in a conservation easement or in a fee simple. But the Rural Family Land Statute, has that component of a 30-year agricultural protection agreement. So with the department's mission being to have that generational farm and protection, how often have you used, or has the department in the past used, the 30-year agricultural protection versus a more perpetual purchase?
Mr. Commissioner, you recognize it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have the statistics on how many we've done in the past. It will not be our goal going forward to do 30-year purchases. We want these to be legacy purchases in perpetuity. And we get that three for right if it happens to be in the wildlife corridor, water recharge, the environment, all of those things. If you say, well, what will be our prioritization? We do have a matrix for that, but those would be my priorities, to make sure that we're doing as much land as possible in large farming communities where we could get the biggest bang for our buck as it relates to environmental concerns and the wildlife corridor.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Alvarez with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, great to see you. Love seeing you up there. I really appreciate what you're doing already for ag and our communities. In my neck of the woods, we have a saying that says the last thing that a strawberry farmer is going to plant is a home. And I recognize that we're trying to stop this. And this effort goes towards that. So understanding that this is a haircut on a fee simple price, right? What is that haircut, number one? And then two, how is it received by someone who can sell to a developer and get really excited by a top dollar?
Mr. Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is a great point. So if you appropriated $300 million for each program, as we did in the past, or in the past couple of years, under a fee simple, clearly you're going to be paying full price for that property. And in some cases around your neck of the woods, that's $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 an acre or more today, right? Sometimes you have, in the farming community, you have those granddads we were talking about earlier that want this farm to be a legacy farm. And they're smart people. They could go out and they could sell that land for $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 an acre. But they would rather negotiate with us for $15,000 or $20,000 an acre to buy those development rights. So what I just described is the multiplier effect of what happens when you bring it to family rural lands. If all of your property purchases are going to be through fee simple, you're going to probably get about a third as much property taken care of as you would through family rural lands. So it's like it's a force multiplier, if you will. And again, there's not a formula that you can put on that because it's different in South Florida versus North Florida. The value of land is so much different. If we were buying development rights in North Florida, it may be 10 times as much, right? If you're buying those same development rights in South Florida, it may be, you know, 3 times as much. But you're getting a 3 or 4 to 1 ratio relative to fee simple through Florida rural lands. But what happens after that? And this is even as important. We do not have to take care of that property as a state. We don't have none of those maintenance costs, none of those fees, none of the programs that we do. We don't have to hire more people, buy more equipment, because those farmers are going to take care of that land and charged with taking care of that land. So when you look at the upfront costs, you probably get 3 or 4 to 1 for your dollar. When you look at every year after that, it's unlimited. It's hundreds of millions of dollars on an annual basis that this legislature can appropriate for other priorities.
Members, questions? Representative Bartleman, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. For the mission military that you spoke of, shouldn't those pieces of land and buffers be a priority and maybe have some flexibility with the rules, like you say, 90% of the appraisal price, since it's a national security issue? Is there leeway for you to do that?
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. we are going to prioritize all above. There's been a bill filed or being filed that would protect our lands around our military bases and so on from foreign buyers. That's a separate issue. On this issue, certainly within this department, we have the ability to buy those development rights around our military installations and military bases, just like any other properties. And we're talking about a willing seller opportunity here. So if we have willing sellers of properties, of development rights around those military bases, it's certainly something we would take a look at.
Follow-up, Representative Bartleman.
Just a follow-up on the bill. Thank you, Chair, if you can indulge me a second. So if you have a bill that prohibits the sale of the military buffers to people outside, what's to stop the guy sitting in the front row over there from purchasing it and then... Like, I'm just curious, like, how, to me, it seems safer for us to have those lands, so.
Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The law that I spoke of is not in statute yet, but we hope it will be in 3 months. And that's going to talk to the idea of our foreign enemies can't come into the state of Florida and buy these lands, agricultural lands, or lands around our military installations. In the case of the Family Rural Lands Act, which is completely separate, we can buy development rights around these military bases if it's in agriculture. So where you have agriculture opportunities around our military installations, we certainly would look at those properties if those buyers get into the process. We will open this process up here in a few months for new opportunities, and if those come into the process, that's something we certainly would look at.
Representative Bartleman.
Sorry, my question wasn't clear. So even if that law does go into statute, you can have someone who is a citizen purchase it and give access. So there is no, like, screening process for that person. Or I just feel like national security should be a priority. And so even if you prohibit the purchase, that doesn't mean, like, when I talk about the guy in the audience, he's buying it, but then he's giving access to whoever he wants. What can we put in place to protect those buffers?
Mr. Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. I believe that was just a constitutional issue. I'm an American and a Floridian. If I want to buy land beside a military base that's vacant or it's for sale, I can buy those properties. And as an American, I should have the right to do those things. If I'm a friendly foreign government, perhaps I've got the right to do those things. And I think the bill we're speaking about now, there will be a divestiture process within that bill for people that come onto the legislature's chosen list of foreign enemies.
Mr. Commissioner, and as we continue to talk about the importance around agriculture, conservation, and wildlife corridors, part of that conversation has been around the idea of trail systems as well. I just was curious if you wanted to provide input or feedback around that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I think it's important as we've traveled the state, and I've traveled the state a lot in the last 10 years, we have seen that a lot of our citizens want to, they love biking, they love going down trails and hiking and things. And I think to the extent that we can put trails, and hopefully we will do this in existing facilities. There have been many rail lines in this state through the years that are now taken up, so there's a natural trail there that cuts through these corridors. And I think if we can do it in a sensitive way relative to what we currently are looking at as the totality of the wildlife corridor, it's a great idea. And I know we spent a lot of time 7, 8, 10 years ago under President Gardner looking at all the bike trails that we were putting around the state and connecting South Florida to North Florida through the bike trails. And I think there's a plan, there is a plan that's being executed to make that happen. If we can have people come through this part of the countryside, I think it's a positive thing because it'll bring education to those to the people that do this. It would normally not come out into ag space, the wildlife corridor space, but I think we have to be aware of when humans come into this contact, we need to have the proper facilities there to accommodate those folks so that we're not creating additional problems. And we have natural connecting opportunities, I believe, in the wildlife corridor for our citizens to go through. And so as we put that, as the legislature does that, that would be my one recommendation, is where are the natural opportunities to cut through these spaces that would be the less intrusive on our wildlife, on our environment, and so on, and on our farmers, of course.
Thank you. Great feedback on that. Representative Mooney, I did not forget about you for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. It's great. I love the acquisition of green space. You know, I live in the Florida Keys. Green space is everything to us. As far as the development rights are concerned, is there any program available to the farmers to sell to the commercial side and then put the land into a conservation easement to be in perpetuity so that those development rights are then moved into corridors that are already developed with the influx of people coming to Florida? We don't have a lot of options available, and we want to preserve as much green space. In my opinion, we can never preserve too much. That said, for future generations of the farming communities, when we know that South Florida has very few row crops left, it's mostly small specialty farms now down in the Redland area, is there any program in place to sell development rights to developers and build outside the corridor in what would you consider high-density areas now, and then, of course, dealing with all the zoning and issues that go along with developing in general? So I see that as a long-term benefit to the farm owners, because the grandson may not want to be a farmer that dad wants him to be or grandpa wants him to be, but now there's no value to the land because development rights have been stripped, and you basically are selling conservation land, which we all know ultimately has little value other than a quarter per acre or a quarter for 1,000 acre of development rights, whatever those additions add up to one. So for me, I would think that if there's a process in place long-term for farmers, would have a greater benefit for them financially down the road for their family.
Mr. Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. And that's a great question. The development rights that were bought 20, 30 years ago in the state of Florida, a lot of those were bought at probably less than $1,500 an acre. You had an individual, a farm group, a family that owned that property that made a financial decision at that time to do that. So at that moment in time, or at this moment in time, they're going to sell us what they believe those rights are worth to them. It's a willing seller. And so we're making in a financial exchange just like anyone else would do. What I would also say to you is that the ones that were bought 10 years ago, 20 years ago, those development rights, those farms back then, that at that day, the property may have been worth $5,000 an acre, so we paid $2,000 an acre to buy the development rights. Today, you cannot buy that farm with the development rights gone for less than $10,000. So the asset appreciates. It just not does not appreciate in the same fashion that if you have all of your development rights. The good part is that a farmer can negotiate, a large landowner can negotiate a certain amount of development by giving up that, those development rights on the bigger piece. So if you have 20,000 acres you're taking down, maybe there's, you know, we normally allow, you know, for houses to be built for family members, things of that nature, a certain number of houses, maybe a certain amount of commercial area that's on a site like that, but that's all pre-negotiated. And what the state is purchasing is what we have negotiated. So, yes, if they would have had foresight on what they sold for $1,500 an acre 20 years ago, and they said, well, I'm going to just hold out and see what I can get in the year 2022 with my development rights, clearly that would have been a different number. But the people we're talking about in legacy farms, large landowners, I think have a spirit of wanting to preserve that land. It's sacred to them. They want their families to be able to farm on it. And I would even think to go the next step to say that they will would want someone to farm on it, even if their family decides not to. By buying the development rights, that's what we're guaranteeing with the Family Rural Lands Program.
Rep. Mooney with a follow-up.
Thank you, Chair. So the development rights that you've acquired that are extinguished. They no longer exist in the state of Florida and can never come back, correct?
Commissioner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. That's the ones I have seen. They're in perpetuity.
Okay, thank you.
Members, questions? Mr. Commissioner, thank you so much for taking the time. We're grateful that you could be here with us. Great presentation. Appreciate you answering all our questions as well. We also want to thank Lieutenant Colonel for joining us as well. Phenomenal presentation. I want to thank members of the committee. You guys did great work today. Great questions. Grateful for everyone's input. Next, everyone plan to join us for next committee week. We're putting together a pretty robust agenda, so it should be good. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing no further business, Representative Trunow moves we rise without objection.